Welcome to the March 17th meeting of the Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee. I wish you all a happy St. Patrick's Day. I know it's a little green around the room. Nice to see that. So first we're going to start with approving the minutes from March 10th. Representative Rarick, have you had time to review the minutes from March 10th?
Yes, ma'am. So moved.
Thank you. Is there any discussion?
Chair
Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a request. Oh, I need to find it now. Just at the line where it says the committee heard an overview, a request is just say the committee heard a presentation entitled and then the title overview of the Minnesota fraud problem, if that makes sense, because that's the was the title of the presentation.
Sure. We're happy to make that amendment.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, the CLA has taken down the amendment, and so the minutes as approved. All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed?
Thank you.
All right. Excellent. So we would now like to welcome to the committee a presentation from the Department of Human Services Behavioral Health Administration. And we're delighted to have you all here in committee. So I'm not sure, is Commissioner Gandhi, are you going to be starting or? Okay. Great. Why don't you just introduce yourselves for the record and we will start going through your presentation, members. We are going to have questions relevant to a slide, have questions at that time, but then we're going to try to move through the presentation and then save the bulk of our questions for the end if that is amenable to everyone. So we'll see how that goes. So good morning. Please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Madam Chair, good morning. I'm Teresa Steinmetz. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Behavioral Health Administration. Happy to be here. So I just want to start off stating that Minnesota is a state committed to helping individuals and that we at DHS and in the state and in the Behavioral Health Administration are committed to providing services that improve the lives of Minnesotans. We know that fraud against these public programs is unacceptable. It's not a victimless crime by any means, and the individuals that within our administration we're trying so hard to support are those most impacted when it occurs. So starting July 31st in 2024, DHS established the Behavioral Health Administration. That was a time when we split apart housing and behavioral health. This was a really important change for many reasons. We're currently in the midst of a national behavioral health crisis and a national opioid crisis, and we're seeing more and more individuals needing services than ever before. Providers share that these individuals have more complex needs, putting a strain on our providers during the midst of a national workforce shortage as well. Having a behavioral health administration that allows for focused support on behavioral health in Minnesota is a really great change. This restructure has also allowed for a more dedicated focus on procedures and oversight of important work like grants and contract administration, which we know in the administration has been an area where improvements have been needed in BHA for some time. By structuring children, family, and adult mental health services and substance use disorder services into its administration, DHS is much better able to develop a strong leadership team, which again can allow for focused direction over the operations area with an emphasis on monitoring grant and contract compliance. We are better able to focus on the increase in behavioral health needs in Minnesota, specifically after the pandemic. We're able to work more closely with the DHS Central Grants and Contracts team to redesign the grant processes within the administration. And we're also better able to work alongside the DHS Healthcare Administration on several new areas of Medicaid, waivers and state plan amendments, and also work more closely with OIG for grant oversight. There are multiple functions within the Behavioral Health Administration. Individuals with mental health and substance use needs require a robust system of care. They really need access to services and supports within the community as well as in residential settings. BHA must take a strategic look at gaps in the system to continue to move towards increased access, better practice, and evidence-based interventions. while at the same time assuring we are being good stewards of state and federal funding, monitoring compliance, and intervening when there are concerns of misuse or fraud. Some of the key functions within both mental health and substance use program areas include policy development and oversight, systems transformation and support of best practices, funding and resource allocation, data collection and reporting, community engagement, education and technical assistance, crisis management and support, and then grant management and contract administration. I have a long career working with and in other states, and really want to just highlight and share that Minnesota has many more innovative programs and supportive dollars, specifically at the state level, focused on mental health and substance use needs than a lot of other states. That funding shows a dedication to and allows for individuals to receive care that others aren't always able to access. And again, I just want to highlight a couple of those successful programs, although there are many, and what they've accomplished so far. The fact that over 300,000 individuals, or at least 25% of those enrolled in Medicaid, receive some type of mental health or substance use related service is really impressive. And we also have additional supportive grant funding that we track in the mental health information system, which shows at least another 35,000 individuals who are reported to be receiving some type of support. A couple of the specific program areas that I wanted to just highlight is the Scott County Coordinated Response Team. So Scott County received the Circle of Excellence Award for their great and innovative. They launched their response team in 2023 to really help bridge gaps in services in their community. This partnership between Scott County, the Scott County Sheriff's, Savage Police Department, and Shakopee Police Department was created in order to have social workers who are trained in engagement and outreach and de-escalation connect with individuals in their jail settings and also those in the community that they had engagement with that were struggling with mental health challenges. It's been a really successful program and just shows some of the great work in Minnesota. We also have the SchoolLink Behavioral Health Program, which serves over 20,000 students. Reports show that the individuals in these schools struggling with mental health can receive the school-based service, and they've really shown improvements on task behavior, increased emotional regulation, a decline in school absences, and better decision-making. One of the exciting things about this program.
If I can interrupt you one moment, Vice Chair Anderson has a question. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. I have a question. So on the number of people, have we looked at data across states? I mean, it's not a win that we have, 25% of Medicaid enrollees are in mental health programs. Necessarily, it's a win if it's actually working, if we're actually seeing progress. So do we have any kind of data comparing Minnesota to other states, maybe that don't have these programs, as to the percent of our folks that, just looking at, and I know you don't do homelessness, but that's a very good example. Okay, do we have less homeless people? Okay, is it actually working, or are we just creating the system? So do you have that data?
Ms. Steinmetz.
Have you done any comparison to see if these things are actually working?
Madam Chair, Representative, we do have data that shows the impact of the programs. When it comes to behavioral health, it's really difficult to show cause and effective relationships because there's so many things that are going on to support individuals in their recovery. I do not have that data with me at the tip of my fingers today, but when you look at those engaged in treatment, and Minnesota is higher with engagement and services that it can offer than other states, just having access is very important in a state. So we can definitely get more of that state-to-state comparison and share it with you. And having multiple access to treatment programs is also an important step to the behavioral health system.
Thank you. I would like to see that. I think there's questioning going on, everywhere about everything. Do programs actually work? It's not a win that people are enrolled. It's a win if people are, helped. right? Actually, the numbers change. And so it would be very good to see that. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I used to work at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, and I can tell you that there are metrics to know that the people that graduate from there, that finish the program, do very well. So depending on the study, anywhere between 75 and 86% remain sober after 5 years. That's a very simple metric. Mm-hmm. You can definitely produce metrics, especially with people that have sobriety issues, mental health issues. You can see, are they not homeless? Are they stable? Do they have employment? There are many, many, many metrics that you can use. So I reject that idea that we don't have metrics, can't have metrics. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I think that that's not a good answer, Madam Chair. So I would just point that out. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Steinmetz, please continue.
Okay, so the last highlighted area I want to talk about on this slide is the Behavioral Health Fund. So the Behavioral Health Fund is, again, a unique fund in Minnesota that provides funding for substance use disorder, comprehensive assessments, and treatment services to eligible Minnesota residents. This slide illustrates a high-level organizational chart within the Behavioral Health Administration. Below each of these areas listed here are multiple units, teams, and staff supporting the work of the administration. Those individuals within those roles really play multiple roles and carry multiple responsibilities due to the nature of the work we do. Of the total staff in BHA, which is approximately 210, there are about 50 grant managers, and again, carry responsibilities such as systems transformation, grant management, and contract administration.
I'm sorry, could you restate those numbers? I was looking for something. How many in the department and how many are grants managers?
210 in the administration and 50 are grant managers.
Thank you.
Not solely grant managers, though, carrying multiple roles.
Thank you.
Within the administration currently, we oversee approximately 90 grant programs at any given time, with about 1,000 contracts supporting all of that work. One of the strategic decisions that we made and implemented specifically within the last 6 months is to strengthen the leadership over the operations section. We know that in order to continue to make necessary improvements, it's important to have dedicated leadership specifically supporting the grants, contracts, and process improvement area. So the Deputy Assistant Commissioner is now overseeing all of the operations areas with support from me as the Assistant Commissioner, and I've taken on more of a lead in all of the programmatic areas, overseeing the program directors, fiscal directors, so that those process improvements can be the number one focus of that team. We've also hired a contracts and compliance unit manager who has experience with audits to support improved oversight of the grants and contracting process. We're setting up processes, procedures, and compliance monitoring within the new unit with really an emphasis on staff training, development, and support to make sure that all necessary documents are completed, uploaded in our contract integration system, and that timelines are being met. One important role within our grant management and contract work is that of the grant manager. As a grant manager, the staff oversee the grant-making process, which I'll discuss in a minute. They have to build relationships with the grantee, provide direction and coordination on all phases of the grant lifecycle, and monitor the oversight of the grant. This includes things like site visits, financial reconciliation, invoice oversight and approval, reporting, and the final closeout evaluation. The contract specialist role for staff includes being the liaison between the contracts and legal compliance, giving direction on all phases of the contracting process, again ensuring that all state and federal laws and regulations are being followed. With federal grants that come into the department, there are also additional requirements and specific allowable populations that can be supported that we need to pay attention to. The contract specialist must assure that those mandates are followed and also coordinate and manage the RFP process, draft and execute the contracts and amendments, and provide the technical assistance, monitoring, and general consultation to all BHA staff related to contracting processes.
Thank you. If you don't mind, Representative Rarick has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in that process, I've been talking to a few folks within DHS, and there's concerns that maybe less than 25% of the time that progress reports are actually received. And when they are, they're not reviewed, and they just kind of go into a circular file and nobody really looks at them. So can you talk a little bit more about your process from issuing the RFP, going through the grant process, and progress reports and reconciliation? Because I'm hearing from people on the inside that those processes aren't really being done. I'm just curious what you have to say about that.
Ms. Steinmetz.
Madam Chair, Representative. So I've been here for 6 months now, and I can say that those processes have been rolled out in the recent past and that they are being executed. We meet with the leadership team. We're pulling information out of the contract integration system and really making sure that the documents that need to be completed are uploaded into that system. So when they're missing or if they're not in there, we can loop back with the staff or the individuals overseeing those contracts, making sure that the performance reports, again, are saved, uploaded, and in the system. I haven't seen that those processes aren't being followed. And again, there's always room for improvement and making sure there's checklists for the staff, making sure that the oversight is easier. I think part of the challenge when you have a lot of transition of staff is that it takes a while to learn how to monitor contracts and monitor grants. And so we need to make sure that we're providing the necessary training and technical assistance so even the new staff are able to do that.
Representative Rick.
Thank you. Really quick, a follow-up. So is all the information back into the contract grants integration system? I was told that there was some crucial data that had been removed. Has it been returned now so you can track grants more effectively?
Ms. Steinmetz.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know anything that has been removed, but again, I've been here 6 months. From my perspective and what I've been shared with from the staff, everything we're needing is in there. One of the struggles with a system like that, though, is that the staff have to upload everything themselves. So you have to have checks and balances in place to make sure that that's happening. It's really easy to forget to do some of that when it's a lot of different humans needing to remember to upload documents, which is why we are now having our compliance unit manager in place, making sure they're checking and then assisting if the staff isn't getting it uploaded in there.
Thank you, Ms. Steinmetz. I just wondered, you say you've been there 6 months. What was your role previous to this?
Sure. So Madam Chair, I do have 30 years experience working in mental health and substance use, mostly in the state of Wisconsin. But I left that state, moved here 6 months ago to really take the leadership role within this administration. I come from a similar role in Wisconsin where I was overseeing the Bureau of Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery, which focused on all the community-based programs. We also had 1,000 grants and a smaller staff and had systems in place. So I'm really hoping to bring that expertise and experience to implement in this administration as well.
Thank you. And my understanding is that you do rely heavily on the Deputy Assistant Commissioner who's overseeing all these behavioral health programs. Is that what you testified a minute ago?
Madam Chair, no, we have reorganized a bit since I've come. So when I first moved into my role, the Deputy Assistant Commissioner was overseeing all of the program directors and operations as well, and then management levels below that. We've restructured so that the Deputy Assistant Commissioner can focus just on the operations section more intently with support from me, obviously. And then I am now overseeing all of the program directors so that that person is not spread so thin and can really focus on improving and leading the processes that we need to continue to implement when it comes to grants, contracts, tracking, monitoring, developing the training programs necessary for our staff.
Thank you. All right, please continue.
All right. This chart really illustrates the dramatic growth in grants over the past 10 years. And if you look at the numbers on there, it shows an output increase of over 333% when you look at that trend, with really consistent or similarly consistent staffing throughout all of those years. So it's just an important illustration of the additional amount of funding that has come in the last few years from the state, which is amazing, to support mental health and substance use programming, as well as from the federal government with our COVID-related dollars.
Can I ask?
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. Generally, what are these? I mean, it's a huge exponential, increase. Okay, so it's 24. It's almost 1,200 different grants. So what are generally these grants? And are they generally federal dollars or both or state or?
Ms. Diamonds.
Madam Chair, Representative, they are both. So there was a lot of state legislative dollars that went through in the past sessions, which again is a great a testament to the support that Minnesota gives to individuals with mental health and substance use needs. And there was also a lot of federal grants attached to our mental health and substance use block grants to support COVID-related challenges. We know that with the pandemic, mental health and substance use increased exponentially. And the federal government gave additional dollars to help with that, as well as the state legislative dollars.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, but between, let's say 23 and 24, that's not COVID, right? So that increase is all state dollars?
Ms. Diamonds.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, the 23, I would say, is the majority of the legislative dollars that came through.
And if I can follow up on that, are there still federal COVID dollars in the system, or has that all gone through? Or are you still dealing with one-time COVID money in any of these programs?
Madam Chair, we do still have one-time COVID-related funding from the federal government that was attached to the mental health and substance use block grants. Those end in September of 25. However, there is potential that they would get extended a year. There are Consolidated Appropriation Act funding has recently ended just within the last couple weeks, and that was the first additional pot of federal funding that came to states. And then the ARPA dollars came after that.
And so how are you differentiating with the one-time money so that it's not creating ongoing obligations?
Madam Chair, that's a great question, and part of what I've really been trying to assess since I've come here, really what's the sustainability plan for those funds. When they were distributed, I think they were really given to different programs that were already in existence to help expand and increase access. And a lot of those you can use as infrastructure development grants to kind of get up and running and expand services that then will be Medicaid billable in the future. So I would say that's one of the strategies, is providing the technical assistance to those providers to see what can continue. That's not the case with all of them. And so then the discussions are about how do we transition to different services, supports, how do we support the lessening funding as it comes forward.
Thank you for that. I would love to get sort of an actual accounting of where that money went and how much is left. And I'm interested in a follow-up question on, you said some of the money was used for expanding infrastructure so that you could create future Medicaid billable services. Could you explain what that means?
Madam Chair, when new funding comes into a state, oftentimes it takes time for a new program to get up and running. So that's what I mean when I'm talking about infrastructure development, time to hire new staff, time to train the staff, time to get supervisors in place for these clinical services. And then once your staff is on board, you can start actively seeing, treating individuals with supports and treatment services. That's how you get to the sustainability piece, because then Medicaid can be billed or other insurances.
Terrific. So I would love to see what programs you are investing in that will create future Medicaid billable opportunities like that. So one of my concerns is that in 2017, Minnesota became one of the first states to have the early intensive development and behavioral interventions. for Medicaid services, and then in 2019, they added the peer recovery services, which is eligible for Medicaid. So we are rapidly growing compared to other states what is eligible for Medicaid, and those are the programs where we've seen a lot of the problems. So it concerns me to hear you're continuing to do that as sort of a model of wanting to expand Medicaid even further when we don't have a handle on how those programs are being run right now. And we've seen double billing, we've seen triple billing. Like, there are serious problems in the Medicaid expansion programs we've already done, and you see the growth. I mean, that coincides. If 2019 was the start of the peer recovery services, and that's one of the big pots where this is going, I have concerns. So I would just love a list of what you're planning on expanding, and so we're able to track that going forward. Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, and good morning. Sorry, I was a few minutes late. I have a question, but before, I have a question about the sort of growth, because since I have been in the legislature, you know, I came in during the pandemic, and I know one of the places of real bipartisan focus has been on dealing with the mental health crisis, the substance abuse crisis, that both came in with opioids and fentanyl, and also with the pandemic. And I think the residue of the pandemic. So I guess this does not surprise me. One thing I just wanted to clarify, because I think that there's some confusion, and I actually agree with Representative Anderson, it would be helpful, and I think what she asked would be to see sort of how we compare to other states in terms of how we are responding to that crisis. What I don't think I heard, and I think just to clarify what Representative Rarick said, is that you don't have metrics. I heard you say that you could provide those for us after the fact, but I just wanted to clarify, make sure that I was hearing that correctly, that you said you didn't have at your fingertips, but you'd be able to provide them.
Ms. Temnitz.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we do have metrics. I just do not have them here with me today, so we definitely can provide them.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. I think the question I have, and, you know, we are focused on the resources, not the problems or communities, and that's sort of the nature of this committee. We're not in DHS or HHS Health or Human Services Committee. Can you talk a little bit about, and I think because we sort of see things that are disconnected on this graph to what we are hearing in other spaces. I know, I remember one of the great successes of the 2022 session was the bipartisan investment in mental health. I know that was a really big priority for many in all four caucuses, actually. And then I know that since we've been trying to get a handle on what are the kinds of things we're doing to invest in communities all over the state to handle this crisis we're seeing. Can you talk a little bit about, and I know that that's not the jurisdiction of this committee, but since it got brought up, this rise, can you talk a little bit about what you've seen in the last 4 years that would give rise to the need for more services in our community and what is actually happening in our community that we're trying to address?
Ms. Temnitz.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is a great question, and I think that's always the balance of when you're working in mental health and substance use. The need has risen immensely. People need treatment, they need services and supports at a rate that we have never seen with this mental health and substance use crisis that we're currently in. And it is a balance between making sure you have checks and balances, certifications, policies and procedures in place for those providing the supports to the individuals, but also making sure that the people in Minnesota aren't struggling. We are putting out resources for harm reduction to try to lessen the deaths from overdose and with opioids. We have investments, again, I know peer and recovery supports. It is a best practice and also requires certification, which we're hoping to move towards so that there are more oversights in place. But those services and supports are key so that individuals can move into recovery and also continue to reduce harm, right? I mean, the suicide rates are increasing, death by overdose is increasing, and we need to have supports out there to meet those needs. There's been, I know, just some funding that has gone into culturally appropriate services. So we have grants that are supporting expansion of that, really looking at the more impacted communities throughout the state trying to provide supports, and the community members are actually providing the support. So a lot of funding goes to target, again, the interventions that we know are best practice. There's studies everywhere about what is helpful, what is not. There's strategies at national levels, and we really try to embrace those as we expand supports and services. Thanks for the question.
Representative Rarick. Then we're going to move back to the presentation. So,
My question is directly to the presentation. So on the slide that we have in front of us, my question is, does the agency have transfer authority? In other words, do you have the legislative authority to transfer money between these contracts?
Ms. Steinmetz.
Madam Chair, Representative, not typically. If the contract is flagged for a certain amount of funding, or are you requesting if one grantee isn't utilizing their funds, could we give it to a grantee of the same orientation?
Yes, Claire. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, right. So if, are you able to move funds after you've let these contracts between the contracts? You have the legislative transfer authority to move money around in that way. Can you move money around in your contracts integration system?
Ms. Steinmetz.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe the contract integration system isn't necessarily the tool we use for funding transfers. That is a different system within the department. The contract integration system is really about tracking all of the necessary components of a grant in order to manage the compliance.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in that contracts, you had said that since you've been there in the last 6 months, that all the important financial data has been put back in, because in my notes I have that February of 2024, the chief financial officer asked for that data to be removed, and I guess since then it's been reintegrated in. But you're able to see the total amount of the grant that was appropriated or let, and then you can see progress reports, so you can see how much of it's been spent or reimbursed, and then you can see the bottom line of how much is left. So my question is, whatever is left, if there's too much and left, can you transfer it to a different contract?
Ms. Steinmetz.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a great question, and I think really would be better well suited for our fiscal staff. We do have a fiscal database. I know we have a budget director within the Behavioral Health Administration that helps oversee that and works closely with our financial office in DHS. That is not a piece of the contract integration system. I apologize if I was said that in a confusing way before. They're two separate systems. So the money stuff can happen, but definitely a question for our financial staff.
Ms. Steinmetz, if I might follow up on that just for a minute. Are you bringing some fiscal staff up? Fantastic. While she's coming up, just Representative Rarick had assumed that the data that was taken out of the contracts integration system in February of 2024 has been restored. Is that true?
Madam Chair, if the information that you were referencing was fiscal in nature, that would be something I'd have to look into, unless maybe someone else knows. I wasn't here when it was removed, or I don't even know what that was at that point in time, so I'd have to do some more research unless anyone on the team knows.
Thank you. I just wanted the record to show that we're not clear whether it's been restored or not.
Yeah.
Commissioner Gandhi, thank you.
Chair
Please
Robbins.
Say your name for the record.
Chair
Sorry.
Robbins, Shireen Gandhi, temporary commissioner for the Department of Human Services. I am not aware of any data that has been removed from the contracts integration system. I would be happy to look into that further. And as Assistant Commissioner Steinmetz said, the contracts integration system is the source of truth for our documents related to individual contracts. And as she also stated, our CFO and our finance staff team use other state systems to track the money. So I'm not aware of any financial data that was removed from the contracts integration system. And if I am wrong, I will correct that.
Great. We look forward to just the follow-up on that. So welcome. Please state your name for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Members, Elise Bailey, Budget Director of the Department of Human Services. I am responding to your question, Representative Rarick, on our ability to transfer money between grants. In any instance of assessing whether we're able to, we would look at what the legal authority behind the money is. Some grants have, say, specific riders saying to X entity for Y amount of money at Z fiscal year. In that instance, if all the funds haven't been spent, that cannot be transferred because it's ridered for a specific purpose for a specific entity. In other instances, funding is appropriated to us within a larger budget activity where multiple grants live. And in those instances, funds can be transferred between grants depending on the need and the RFP and competitive contracting process.
Thank you. Representative Rick, did you have one follow-up?
Thank you. So really quickly, so the chart that we're looking at then, how many of these contracts, because you've got an exponential growth in contracts, and your staff, like you pointed out, are fairly flat. So of these contracts, how many are you legally able to move money between? Is it a small percentage? Is it a big percentage? Like this, there's a big concern that money is being moved and not always following the rules. And so I'm just trying to figure out, like, how much of this money is actually that there's a transfer authority by the legislature already built into this and how much is not. Do you happen to know, like, which is which?
Ms. Bailey.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, I could get back to you on the percentage. I would say in any case where we move money, we make sure that we have legal authority to transfer funds. But I can, get back to you on the question of what percent of the total grants we're able to do that.
Great. Thank you. Moving on. Thank you for your time. Ms. Steinmetz.
Next slide is fine. Since the last OLA report was published in 2024, Again, there are multiple steps in order to implement a grant-making process and fulfill the requirement of grants management. This slide is just illustrating the flow when it comes to a grant all the way through contracting and closeout. It lays out the sequence of about 50 steps needed to do the work. We start with the creation of the request for proposals, which includes the 10 steps listed in box one. We move on to the next 15 steps related to review and selection processes, then on to the initiation of the contract, and then finally the ongoing grant contract management through closeout in that last slide. So we were just really trying to show the steps and the cycle, the life cycle of a grant, which is fairly complex.
Thank you. I'm just going to jump in here. So the OLA had many concerns about the conflicts of interest, both with the community reviewers and with the grant managers themselves. And that's been an ongoing issue. There was the 2024 report that flagged that, but there was a 2019 report, and between 2019 and 2024, Commissioner Harpstead had presented extensively about the Swiss watch theory of the case and that everything was humming along wonderfully, and clearly by 2024, many things had not been fixed. So could you speak to how you are enforcing the conflicts policies in light of the 2024 recommendations and, you know, where you're at in that? Is there still more work to do? Is it actually being enforced now? If you could provide just more detail on that.
Madam Chair, that is a really great question and actually moves us right into the next slide where we're talking about what's been improved and process improvements since the 2024 mm-hmm. audit. One of which is the conflict of interest that have not been completed, not been mitigated if there was a conflict. And so I can talk a little bit about that throughout the slide, if that's
perfect.
Okay. Okay. So since the last OLA report was published in 2024, BHA has implemented many new processes, procedures, and training of existing procedures for staff. We've established quality control measures that require all RFP documentation be uploaded into the contract integration system. And that actually has to happen before the contract administrators and grant managers can start working on them. So we've put some kind of safeguards in place to make sure that things get uploaded. We've also established quality control measures that require that all RFP documentation be uploaded into the contract integration system. We've created and deployed standardized tools and templates to help the grant managers maintain compliance with all requirements. One key important one of that is the conflict of interest. We've hired a contracts and compliance manager and will add quality assurance specialists to support compliance and quality assurance in the grant and contract processes within BHA. There's also been a huge launch of an extensive training program for all BHA grant managers. We have featured more than 25 modules now that span across all the phases of the grant management so that individuals can watch them, relearn them, and attend the trainings. We've also launched an extensive, we've also monitored compliance with the grant and contract requirements through the monthly reports that are now being generated from CIS. So again, as I shared earlier, those reports are being distributed to leadership. We talk about them in our leadership meetings. We make sure that everyone in the administration is completing what needs to be completed when it comes to grants and contracts, and then uploading them in the system as well. We've also implemented a streamlined closeout evaluation process, which uses the integrated form within the system and trained staff on how to assess the grantee performance. We started holding weekly lunch and learns. As I said earlier, contracts and grants can be complicated, especially if you're a new staff within the administration. So really trying to put together mentoring, coaching, and learning system for all of them to help support each other with the leadership of our experts in those areas. I was lucky enough to be able to move into my role supporting the work that had already started within the last couple years and continue to strengthen it as we move forward. Again, rearranging some of the staff to have dedicated focus to our systems and process improvement that, again, we need to continue to build and work on within the administration is of utmost importance.
Thank you. Just before you move on, I appreciate this. It looks like a lot is going on, but to the specific question of are you requiring the community review groups to identify conflicts and then resolve them? And secondly, are you requiring grant managers to state if they have any conflicts? And then are they moved to other grant portfolios if they indeed have a conflict?
Madam Chair, yes, we are. And we actually have started doing some spot checks of all of that work. And we can say that we tested 20 different requests for proposals since April of 23. And BHA actually achieved 100% compliance in completing the conflict of interest forms and then uploading them into the system as well. We've also really focused, again, on the training and support for if a conflict is flagged, how to mitigate that, which means transferring to other individuals, making sure those community members aren't reviewing an application that might be coming in. So those have happened.
Thank you. Yes, just one second. And then you're providing all this training for grant managers and making it available to them. Are they required to take it?
Madam Chair, yes, most of the staff are, if they play a role in grant management, they are attending those trainings and they are asked to go. And then we track who's attending. If they weren't able to make it that day for some reason, we do have recordings that we can offer or have them do a one-on-one connection with the material expert.
But it's not required as part of their job currently.
Madam Chair, I don't believe it's mandated in their position descriptions at this point in time, but I don't know that anyone who plays those roles isn't attending. Their supervisors would talk to them. We would make sure that we're encouraging that and that they are attending.
Thank you. Yes, that's just been one of the OLA's consistent recommendations is that the grant management training is required. So I just like to explore that. I'm sorry, Representative Rarick.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. So to this slide, you've done a lot, you talked about a lot of process improvements here. One of the major concerns, both in the media and with some of the folks we've been talking to, is not just double billing, but sometimes triple and quadruple billing. In other words, this county, state, federal grants get billed, and then also Medicaid gets billed. And so one example is of either double billing or incorrect billing was a report about Evergreen from Care 11. It was one of the examples. Things like one person billed 203 hours in one day and things like that. So I know you've got a slide later about billing, but I just, it really goes into this training. That seems like an obvious overbilling, but I also have concerns not just about double billing, but triple and quadruple billing, where you've got that the county, the state, the federal government grants are billed, and then also Medicaid is billed. And I'm wondering if you're going to be talking about that at all. But specifically in that Care 11 story, it's a pretty obvious overbilling, which is one person being billed for 203 hours in just one day for treatment. So I'm wondering if you could address some of that, if you've dealt with any of that in this training.
Ms. Steinmetz.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that is definitely part of the trainings and discussions. It is a complicated situation when Medicaid is being billed directly to the programs, right? And then you have a grant as well. But one of the things that we would discuss and train with our staff is making sure that federal funds specifically are always legally supposed to be the payer of last resort. So it's really important that our contract specialists and grant managers are understanding what is allowed to be billed to Medicaid and then what grants should be used for. So they need to make sure they're monitoring that as well and part of the oversight, site visits, and work that they are doing as they go out. We also have budget proposals that are talking about midpoint billing and trying to put more specific billing processes in place so that billing would occur in 15-minute increments, which would also increase the safeguards and prevent that from happening as much as it has in the future.
Thank you. Last question, Representative.
Yeah, just follow up. So I think she just said that it's happened in the past. I just wanted, you know, I'm wondering, since it has happened in the past where you've had double billing, triple billing, quadruple billing, does the contracts integration system even address that, or do you use a different system? Is it in Swift? Like, where is this information housed so someone could actually look at it and say, oh, well, this bill came in and it went, they tried to bill, you know, three different grants and then also Medicaid. How do you even see that?
Ms. Steinmetz. Yes, Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick. This is a challenge of data systems that don't talk to each other, so it is more labor intensive to catch that. Yes, the Medicaid payments go out through a different system. The contracts integration system is built on a platform called Agile Apps, and as I stated earlier, it's more of a document repository at this point in time. Ultimately, one of the things we would like to see the state of Minnesota have is an end-to-end solution that allows from the initiation of grant funding coming into the state to be able to manage it throughout and tie it to the back-end payments. And then it would be much easier to catch those things and put safeguards in place and hard controls that would stop that from happening.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We will probably follow up on that, but let's continue for now. Thank you.
The DHS Behavioral Grants Management Internal Controls and Compliance Audit of March of 21 had what is illustrated on this slide, 28 recommendations for the administration to rectify. And then the next grant award processes evaluation report from 2024 included another four. We're just putting this up here to illustrate that we're happy to report that as of February 2025, of those 32 OLA recommendations, 26 have been totally closed out and resolved at this point in time. The six that remain open, which are from the March 21 report, are in the final stages of closeout. And so within the next couple of weeks, those should be rectified as well. Again, it takes time to improve a system, put in processes and procedures, put in tracking systems, checklists, all of the things we need to do. But really wanted to highlight that most of the past findings have been closed at this point in time.
So if I could follow up on that, when you say closed, you mean you have satisfied the OLA recommendations?
Madam Chair, yes. That would be how you close the finding. You implement what they recommended you do. So once it's implemented, you can close the finding.
So when they recommended requiring community conflict forms and resolving those or resolving conflicts with your grant managers, you're comfortable saying that that is fully resolved?
Madam Chair, I would say, again, there's always room for checks and balances and improvement in the system. We have processes, procedures, and policies in place that the contract administrators and grant managers need to follow. And there's always room for human error and not following something, forgetting to upload it, forgetting to do it. So I am all about systems change and improving processes, and I don't think you're ever 100% in your work where you need to go. So I would continue to work on it, improve it, make sure we're monitoring it until the point where we know that it's being done every single time consistently. But we have the process in place. We did the spot check for the 23 RFPs that went out, and all of those conflicts of interest were done. So we are making progress.
Just to follow up on two points there, you did say that all 20 conflict of interest forms were uploaded, but you didn't say the conflicts were resolved. So can you differentiate there for me?
Madam Chair, they would have been resolved if they flagged any conflict of interest, and again, then they're uploaded in the system. So if the conflict of interest exists, we would mitigate that by, again, not having that community reviewer review that application. That happens all the time when grant reviews are happening. If we have individuals that are working in the administration that have ties to that organization and fill it out, they wouldn't monitor those grants. We would reassign. So those things are being mitigated.
Okay. And to that point, one of the OLA recommendations we haven't talked about is single source or sole source contracts. And the recommendation, you know, was for much more clarity on that and for there not to be any conflicts. So could you talk about how you've addressed that and what percentage of your grants and contracts are sole source versus competitive?
Madam Chair, I would have to get that percentage exactly for you to provide my experience, and what I've seen in the administration so far is that there is not a large amount that's a sole source. There are some funding allocations that are earmarked for certain agencies mm-hmm. and go directly to them, so that is a different venue that you have to follow. But most of the sole source would need to be because that is the only entity that can provide the service if the administration was doing that on their own. It is a different process, again, if someone stated in legislation to be getting that funding.
Thank you, and I understand that. And we are working bipartisanly here to create a culture where we do not have as many legislative name grants. So we will continue to try to partner with you on that. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. And yes, I endorse that. Hardly endorse that last sentence you just expressed. I just want to go back to the conflict of interest issue for a second. As I understood it in the OLA report, what they were identifying was sort of gaps in paperwork, which actually helpfully on the slide in front of us, but that I guess I'm not aware of there having been actual conflicts that were identified. And I could be wrong about that. If you could just sort of clarify that we're talking about gaps in terms of sort of documentation, rather than there being something the OLA actually found where there was, in fact, a conflict, whether an internal staff or an outside reviewer.
Ms. Steinmetz.
Chair Robbins, if I could answer that question.
Oh, Commissioner Gandhi, yes.
Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto. Yes, you're correct. The OLA, when they find that documentation isn't present, then they say that, you know, they can't confirm whether we have addressed it or not. But you're correct. We did not receive any findings for actually having a conflict of interest.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. Just want to point out that the OLA doesn't typically look at that in the first place. So they look at the paperwork. They don't look at whether a conflict actually existed. That's more of a legal investigatory, issue. So I just want, we don't know, is it the answer. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. Please continue, Ms. Diamonds.
Slide 13 is showing that BHA has done much work to improve its grant oversight in the recent past, and although there are still improvements to be made, the resolution of the audit findings on this slide is a great start to better oversight and compliance with the grant cycle requirements. The resolve past findings seem to be centered around internal controls and compliance monitoring, as well as record keeping, personnel and training, and grant application and award processes. We continue to ensure documents are completed and stored appropriately in the CIS system. Again, these include completion of the conflict of interest forms and also mitigating any conflict of interest that might arise. Next slide. I can also share that the position descriptions have been updated related to grant management, and training has occurred for all staff. Tools and templates have been standardized and are being utilized throughout the Behavioral Health Administration. BHA has put in place procedures at all levels to support the required practices when it comes to grant monitoring. We're using the contract integration system and are pulling information from that system to monitor that the documentation is present in the system. Again, we've started sending out notices to staff and supervisors tracking progress on completion before due dates of those grants and contracts. And we're utilizing our leadership meetings to talk about progress on those completion reports as well. Doing all we can to continue to increase the visibility of the need to make sure that this is done in an appropriate manner and that everything is completed so that we can do all we can to ensure good grant and contracting processes. I shared a little bit of these data points before, but again, I just want to re-stress that we're really happy to report that when we did the test and pulled the compliance check again, that of those 20 RFPs published since April 23, we had 100% compliance in uploading the conflict of interest forms to CIS, and our contract closeout process also has shown the improvement in that area, completing the evaluation at the closeout, which has financial reconciliation, many different pieces to it, reaching 97% of those closeout requirements for July 31st ending contracts, and those that just ended in August, we had 100% compliance. And I will turn it over to Commissioner Gandhi.
I'm sorry, did someone have a question? Oh, yes, sorry, Commissioner Gandhi. Sorry, I was reading on something. Please continue.
Chair Robbins, members of the committee. While Teresa was talking about the work that is done within an administration to oversee grants, I also wanted to share the additional work done in operations to support our program areas. So this slide provides an overview of the different levels of support and that aid in providing oversight and controls in the process. Our Contracts and Legal Compliance Division has attorneys and contract coordinators who help make sure that our contracts meet the requirements set out for state contracts so that they are legally enforceable and meet all the requirements that both are in statute and that the Office of Grants Management requires. We also have the Central Grants Office, which is newly established. It started in 2022 with just a couple staff, and then thankfully the legislature appropriated funds so that we could have a more robust Central Grants Office, and that was in 2023. And the Central Grants Office is the division that owns the contracts integration system that supports it. And they also develop policies, procedures, training, and technical assistance for our grant managers across the organization.
Question.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. Can you? This is not Department of Admin. This is a separate
thing.
This
is within DHS.
Okay.
Yes.
Can you, as you do this, finish the slide, talk about what admin is doing and what they're looking at a statewide grants management system.
Yeah. I actually have a slide that will cover that.
Thank you.
Yep.
Continue, Commissioner Gundix.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. The next box down under the Central Grants Office is our Office of Internal Controls and Accountability. That's where our internal auditors sit. And this area has recently developed a grants audit unit, and they are going to work on regularly testing our internal controls and as well be available to audit grantees whenever we flag something that is a question or concern. And then lastly, the compliance office at DHS houses all of those areas, the contracts and legal compliance division, the central grants office, and the Office of Internal Controls and Accountability, and they have oversight and with the program areas and work directly with process control champions to support the internal controls that are taking place within the program areas and also provide a way for any concerns that are happening in the program areas to have an independent place where those concerns can be reported. So the next slide I wanted to cover, because I know the Department of Administration came to this committee and presented on their controls, so I wanted to just share with this group how we connect with that. So the Department of Administration, centrally for the state of Minnesota, sets the rules and has been implementing from an enterprise-wide place the 2023 grant requirements. And DHS on its side, on our side as an agency, have been in close contact with them each step of the way, making sure that we are doing what we need to as an agency to comply with those enterprise requirements. And so I won't go through all of these, but I just wanted to flag for you that we have completed each step, and we are on track to be ready to go April 2025 as required with grantee evaluations as well. The last item, number 12, I wanted to flag for you because I have heard some legislators think that when the grant dollars increase for an agency, the staffing can increase. And I wanted to let you know that that's not the case for DHS. So we have not implemented that because it conflicts with how we receive funding. And there are legislative chairs and analysts who have not been supportive, and some of the legislation specifically says that DHS cannot use the funds in that way. And on top of that, we actually have some technical challenges because of our budget structure. So just wanted you to be aware that as you see that exponential growth in funding, that we are not able to take that administrative cost.
Thank you. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly on the previous slide, you said something that kind of caught my attention. In the fourth bullet point down for Office of Internal Controls and Accountability, you said that these are that this will happen. So is has any of this been implemented, or is this, like, where is this in the process of actually happening and being in effect?
Ms. Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, are you specifically asking about the grant auditors?
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you had said something about in this bullet point that these things will be happening. Are some of these not implemented yet? Like, where are we at in the process of this, of actually having really good accountability and internal controls? We've got so many examples. I could talk for an hour or two or three of things that have gone sideways, and it's been all over the media, from Care 11 to KSTP5 and other places where we've got fraudulent activity, double billing, all kinds of different things. So I'm asking you, when has this gone into effect? And if it has not, when will it go into effect? This literally the fourth point down you have.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, they are in effect now.
Madam Chair.
Last question, Representative Rarick.
When did it go into effect?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, which item?
Representative Rarick.
Let's go bullet point one, that you conduct internal audits and coordinates with external auditors, with OLA, OSA, and so on, FBI.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, that has been in place since the internal control, since the internal audits division has been in existence, and that is, I don't know, 30 years or more.
Commissioner Gandhi, could you elaborate how many audits are conducted every year internally, roughly?
Internal audits?
The audits referenced here conducts internal audits and coordinates external audits, so the internal audits.
Internal audits, I would say, are probably 10 or fewer a year.
Okay.
It depends on the comprehensive nature and what's being audited and the amount of time that it would take to conduct it.
This is a particular concern to me on this internal controls aspect. I have here a presentation Commissioner Harpstead gave in 2019 when I was a freshman, and she swore they were bringing in all these Sigma Six lean experts, and they hired new consultants, and they had moved the internal financial controls division under the CFO, and I have lists of things she said they were doing in 2019 that have not seemed to solve the problem. So just, I guess I'm looking for, if I'm still here in 6 years and look back on this presentation today, how will we see measurable progress in cutting down on the fraud and the abuse in DHS? Because I get there are processes that you've been working on, but that's what we were told in 2019, and many of the recommendations from 2019 were not followed up on, even though we were told they were. So how can we do better as a legislature in providing oversight to ensure that these are happening? Because clearly there's been continued issues. So I would welcome your feedback. What can we do better to make sure this is actually happening? Commissioner Gandhi.
Representative or Chair Robbins, thank you very much for that. And we have continuous improvement is by its very nature something that you never stop working on. So we are always working to strengthen our internal controls. Since I have been at DHS, we have followed through on recommendations. Every recommendation, we have a detailed audit tracker that our internal audits team keeps, that keeps all of the OLA, OSA, HHS findings, every single one, including our internal audits, and follows through on those, working with the program areas to their resolution. And at DHS, we are a large agency, $25 billion, and our payment accuracy is greater than 99%. But even a small error is large in magnitude, and every dollar counts. So it's not surprising that it makes news and catches the attention. It doesn't mean we aren't working on it. And what I would say in terms of help from the legislature would be that the more complex we make programs and we make funding, the more challenging it is to have accuracy. So it's very important that we subtract requirements that aren't adding value and focus on the ones that are really going to make sure that we have program integrity and high quality.
Thank you. All right, please continue.
So as I move into talking about fraud, I just want to reinforce that Minnesota, we should be proud of Minnesota as a state that is committed to helping people and that we're committed to providing services that improve people's lives. And fraud against these public programs is unacceptable. It harms the same people that we're trying to help. So going back to a question that you posed in the letter to us to present today, You wanted to cover payment withholds. And so payment withholds are a temporary action to stop payments to providers during an investigation. And there are several factors, several times when DHS may issue a payment withhold. When there's a credible allegation of fraud, if a provider doesn't provide access to a program or record, if there's false or misleading information, and to protect the public welfare. And Minnesota statute defines what a credible allegation of fraud is. How often do payment withholds happen? Here are the totals across the 5 years. It's about 725 times over the past 5 years. And in that time, we've done about 4,000 investigations. So the governor's payment withhold proposal would help with some gaps that we see. And I think before we were discussing why can't DHS do some of these things already. And by expanding the current law, as the proposal does, we can take action without being told by a court, or at least reducing the likelihood that a court would tell us that we're acting arbitrarily or without the proper authority. So, for example, if under number one, we're talking about criminal conviction related to fraud, and if somebody's already been convicted of a crime and there's not an ongoing investigation, then we can terminate them from the program, but they have appeal rights, and then the appeal rights allow the money to continue to flow. So this provision would allow us to shut off the money while the administrative action is pending. And in each of these areas, there's sort of detailed legal nuances that our staff are saying would make it stronger and less likely to be overturned by courts or face questions by courts.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. I'm very interested in this, obviously. Has that actually happened, that you are stopped by a court? I mean, even like the Feeding Our Future, they weren't actually stopped by a court. So they say they were, but they weren't, you know. So, but has that actually happened where courts are saying no, even though there's fraud, you have to continue paying them? Or is this little, I guess that's my question, and happened how many times? So,
Commissioner Gandhi. Yeah.
Chair Rarick, Vice Chair Anderson, I think I think the challenge is that we don't want to waste state resources trying things that we don't have authority. So at DHS, we tend to not take action unless there's clear authority to do so.
Madam Chair, so no, so you're saying no, that courts haven't actually stopped that. They haven't prevented you from withholding.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Vice Chair, I would need to ask our legal team that question.
Okay.
What we're trying to do is strengthen our ability to take action against the bad actors, and I'd ask for your support for that.
Thank you. I do have a question. So this is the governor's proposal, but my understanding is you already can withhold payment when there's a credible allegation of fraud. Is that not already true?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
We'd also like to have a proposal that would allow us to be more transparent with our payment withhold information. Currently, that is payment withhold is classified as confidential data. So this would mirror the current authority of the commissioner to disclose the existence of an investigation. Next slide. In terms of anti-kickbacks, just quickly to define what a kickback is, it's when an individual or entity offers an incentive to another person to induce that person to receive an item or service that is eligible for public funds reimbursement. Kickbacks are federally illegal, and existing federal law prohibits the use of kickbacks. DHS and state law enforcement partners can still react to a kickback, but there also must be evidence of fraud. This proposal fills the gap that prohibits the state from taking action if there's only a kickback.
First of all, yes. Just a moment, Vice Chair Anderson. So is not a kickback already credible evidence of fraud?
Not necessarily, Chair Robbins.
So can you give me an example when a kickback is not credible evidence of fraud?
Chair Robbins? Yes. So, for example, if a entity is soliciting soliciting participants by paying them to participate, but they're actually providing the services and appropriate services are being delivered, and the funds being used to solicit or entice the people to use their services are not coming from state dollars or other dollars that are not allowed for that, then that's an enticement, but there's not necessarily an improper payment that we can act on. And that's not fraud.
We can discuss that after. Commissioner, Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that to me is abuse. That to me is, you know, you have no way of knowing. I mean, you could, you know, you're saying it's direct funds, but if you look at someone's financial, the dollars are coming from somewhere, you know, within that organization. But to me, that's a clear abuse. And if it's looked at as a kickback federally, it's illegal, then clearly it's a, you know, just because it's a federal statute doesn't mean it's not illegal in Minnesota. It's a federal issue. So I just don't understand. I would support whatever can happen to tighten things up, but I also believe that it's already tight and enough to have avoided, you know, the vast majority of the fraud that we've seen here over the last decade or whatever. So thank you.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Vice Chair, I appreciate your support, and I would like Minnesota to join the other 36 states that make kickback illegal so that we have stronger ability to go after that.
Commissioner, you'll be happy to know that my bill is currently awaiting jackets, so we will get that in the hopper, and it may be the first bill our committee hears. Vice Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and I will note that the administration's proposal will be having an informational hearing on, it's going to be introduced on Thursday, and it's having an informational hearing in State Gov. And I think, so just to say that that is on its way as well, I know this is part of the administration's broader proposal regarding these issues. So,
yes, and the administration is also going to present the governor's proposal here at our committee, but
excellent.
I do not believe the
excellent
date has been set. We're working on it.
Okay, thank you.
We also are still waiting for language, which we haven't seen yet. Mm-hmm. Please continue.
Chair Robbins, so these are the additional proposal elements that we are going to ask for your support to pass in the governor's anti-fraud package. And as you noted, we will be back here to share more information on that.
Okay. Thank you. We'd now like to welcome Superintendent Evans. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, Superintendent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and thank you for having me at your committee today. I was asked just to provide a brief overview. I know a lot of what you're focusing on today here has interaction with Medicaid in particular, and so we'll talk a little bit about how that works from there. But one of the items that we wanted to give an overview of was a recent addition or transition, I should say, to a new process that we're working on. One thing that we've recently done through the administrative process through the governor's executive order ordering us to combine all state law law enforcement resources into one particular entity to ensure that we have adequate resources addressing a few different things. That combined the Commerce Fraud Bureau with the Minnesota BCA's Financial Crimes Fraud Section at the BCA, and that was completed on February 7th. That team now is working together in unison and able to take additional cases that involve state fraud for criminal investigation. What that does is it creates a singular coordinated response to identify and disrupt and hold offenders accountable for some of these state program frauds that you're talking about. This unit, just because we're not in front of this committee very often, we'll focus on four main areas. Insurance fraud work that has been done traditionally by the Commerce Fraud Bureau will now be conducted by this new section, which is the BCA Financial Crimes and Fraud Section. And I do want to continue just to reiterate that they are only focusing on criminal fraud. There's a credible allegation of criminal fraud that gets referred to this unit. And this is for all of the different things that they cover. Also, wage theft and misclassification crimes that have been done in some form or fashion by both of the previous units prior to combination. Traditional financial crimes, and as we continue to need to look at that, as I was sitting here, I was reading an article that just last year alone to the Federal Trade Commission, Americans have reported $12.5 billion in individual fraud to them. And so this is a growing area. That's not any state government program fraud. That's just fraud with individuals that we see. And so this is a growing area of crimes that we need to continue to focus on. And lastly, state program fraud that will be covered by this particular unit. This also, as part of this work and part of this transition, we've been working with the Department of Human Services. We've worked together with contracts with them for a number of years, traditionally focusing on CCAP, which I know you've had discussions about here, but we've also had programs in other state agencies, such as DEED, looking at unemployment fraud-related issues there. Also, recently, we completed a contract with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency related to some COVID-related issues that they were experiencing. We also have agents that are assigned to the Social Security Administration and an analyst there. That one's a little bit unique. It's a Minnesota Disability Determination Office that looks at that, but it's a federally run program, so it's all really federal fraud. They're a little bit more insular. The partnership with the DHS, though, is we recently re-engineered our contract with them so that we could expand our focus, not just to be looking at CCAP fraud. And so the new language is all really any government-funded program. If fraud is identified, this unit can then take a look at that along with them. One notable exception that I'll note that's somewhat related today is it does not include MFUCO or Medicaid Fraud Control Unit that's run by the Attorney General's Office. Any suspected Medicaid criminal fraud continues to get referred to the Attorney General's office. However, our new unit is working to strengthen our relationship with the Attorney General's office. That MFUCO unit, Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, we have long worked together with them, both at the Commerce Fraud Bureau and the BCA, when they need to conduct search warrants and do things that licensed law enforcement have to complete. We've provided assistance to them. It's been kind of one-offs as that the work that they need to do that particular work that we assist them with. However, we're looking for ways that we potentially can strengthen the collaboration between them. As I just noted with the number of Americans that are experiencing individual fraud, fraudsters certainly are agnostic in the programs that they wish to target in their process. And so if we can more readily identify people across the spectrum, we want to work together with them to be able to do that and identify if they're involved in multiple programs to take the case that makes the most sense from there. And that, Madam Chair, is real short and sweet on this particular, but happy to answer any questions about that work.
Thank you. I have several questions, then we have a list. I'm not sure who this is for, so I just want to talk for a minute about fraud in the autism centers. That's something we haven't addressed yet today, and that's of great concern to me. So my understanding, just to quick go back to a couple of the earlier slides, have you stopped any payments to any of the autism service providers, or have you revoked or put on temporary suspension any of the licenses for those providers? Commissioner Gotti.
Chair Robbins, we have been, our Office of Inspector General has been doing audits, in-person audits of all providers. They have completed 219 visits so far,
and they have taken various actions as appropriate, including those items that you mentioned. So
payments have been stopped, licenses have been revoked. Can you, be more specific? Commissioner Ghani.
So EIDBI, the autism services, are not a licensed service.
Okay. So have you stopped payments to any of them? Commissioner
Chair
Ghani.
Robbins, I'm hesitating because payment withholds are private, and I would need to check on the data and see if it's large enough sample that I could share with you.
Okay. I respect that. So I just wanted to talk about a couple of the examples that are particularly concerning to me. One is Smart Therapy Center in Minneapolis, and they were given $14 million since 2023, I believe. And one of the problems is that they became a Feeding Our Future site. And so they provide autism centers, but they also became a Feeding Our Future site. And one of the people involved in that pled guilty in the Feeding Our Future, investigation and charging. So are they still providing autism services for the state? Commissioner Ghani.
Chair Robbins. So this is a criminal investigation by the FBI. What I can confirm for you is that DHS had both of the programs that the U.S. Attorney issued search warrants for on its radar, and we participated in the investigations.
And do you continue to provide state money to those two sites that were in the search warrant? And do they continue to provide autism services?
Chair Robbins, payment withhold information is private.
David. Okay. Somehow, I think that's important that we understand. I mean, there are several examples of overlap between 12 defendants in the Feeding Our Future cases and several other organizations that provide or are related to autism centers. And I respect that there's a process, but I think to the extent, and maybe it is making that data public, and I'll be the first one to sign that bill, because it's very concerning that these centers may continue to be receiving state dollars, and there were evidence in the search warrant, if you've read it, as I have, that there were evidences of kickback, of services not being provided, of many of the things we keep seeing over and over again. So I would hope that payments have been stopped, and if they haven't, I hope you will continue to look into that.
Chair Robbins, yes, we are very actively looking into anybody that has been connected to Feeding Our Future and indicted. Starting when that information became available, DHS was very carefully reviewing Medicaid payments, our grants, et cetera. We have found about half of the ones we've looked into had no connection whatsoever that we were able to find to DHS programs. The other half that have connections, we have taken action depending on the program. I'm not speaking specific to EIDBI, but depending on the program, we've taken actions to disqualify people from our programs, to revoke licenses, and to stop payments. And we are continuing to review anybody that's connected to that fraud, because fraud is absolutely unacceptable. And we also
like I mentioned, are doing audits of all of the EIDBI sites that are in-person thorough audits of the programs.
Great. I appreciate that. And if you can share with us who's been disqualified, who's had a revoked license, where you've stopped payments, maybe not by name if that's not permissible, but just a broad overview, especially since, anything tied to feeding our future, that would be super helpful for the committee. I have more questions, but I will turn to Representative Rarick for a moment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought you had others on the list before me, but really quickly, we were talking to an outside expert about investigating fraud, and one of the things that was pointed out that was incredibly important, and I appreciate that you've got Superintendent Evans here. He's one of my faves. And one thing that's really, really important is that when fraud is suspected by your frontline people and they see something that doesn't look right, like 204 hours being billed in one day, that they can escalate that to a specific person that's not their direct supervisor but outside of that. That's a really important thing. So it's my understanding that that hasn't been the course of action here in Minnesota, and that that had led to a lot of problems, a lot of fraud in Minnesota. So with all of this change and all of this restructuring and new departments and all of this, the very basic stuff, can you explain to us the very basic stuff? So you've got a frontline worker that suspects something, that sees something. Who do they escalate it to, and then what happens? And then the second part of that question is, if somebody in the organization then retaliates against that whistleblower, who does that whistleblower then go to get protections and make sure that they are not threatened, their jobs aren't threatened, their livelihoods are not threatened, that they are actually protected? Can you tell us how that happens, those two parts?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, yes. There are quite a few avenues for reporting if frontline staff has concerns. So DHS has an internal confidential hotline. That is one avenue. That goes directly to our internal audits office, or our compliance office, actually. It now goes directly to our compliance office. We also our staff are also instructed to report anything that's appropriate to the Office of the Legislative Auditor, as well as to the BCA. Then in addition to that, staff are able to, can report to MMB. I know on occasion they will go to the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and it might not be something that the Legislative Auditor looks into, but the Legislative Auditor refers it back to us without providing any name information, and we look into the matter and then close the loop with the Legislative Auditor. So there's several different avenues that employees can take to report concerns. In terms of retaliation is prohibited, and it is very important to me that we not do anything that is retaliatory, because employees reporting issues are how we keep program integrity. So retaliation would be looked into by our HR department, and also can be looked into by the MMB, sort of the internal controls and HR functions of the Minnesota Management and Budget.
Thank you. Chair Pinto.
I would defer to Representative Greenman, Madam Chair.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I have a question for Deputy or Commissioner Evans, Director Evans. I'll get it right. Superintendent Evans. It's early. It's Monday morning. One of the things that I think we've seen sort of coming back to the behavioral health space in, you know, New Way and other places in this overbilling is also sort of related issues. And I want to talk a little bit about Kairos, because it was an issue that the legislature actually spent some time dealing with and passed a law. But what we saw there, in addition to overbilling, was the misclassification of workers who were hired as independent contractors. It made it harder, I think, to get to the overbilling issues, but it also was both wage theft and also defrauding the state from unemployment insurance taxes and the tax withholdings in all of those ways that misclassification actually drains public coffers. And in that case, what the legislature did was say, in this model with peer recovery support specialists, it just mandated that they are employees, which I think makes a lot of sense when we're talking about the most vulnerable folks. What was being told, and actually my neighbor had a job like this where he was a career, a peer support recovery specialist, and was told he only got paid when he billed, and he didn't get paid when his supervisor was having meetings with him on his trips to and from, and also was being pressured to overbill. When we did that, Kairos then shut down. When we intervened in that business model that was both defrauding workers and defrauding the government, Kairos shut down. And I am wondering, as you are in this new configuration, which I think is actually really helpful because a lot of these issues have many components, right? And as you said, when we think about fraud and the business model of fraud, there is often the government is the mark, workers are the mark, there may be consumers are the mark. It all sort of fits together. I'm wondering, as you do this consolidation, how in areas like this, where I think there is some vulnerability in the workforce, there's some vulnerability in the billing, how you're structuring or restructuring or thinking about these places so that we can look at all of the elements, including the wage theft, including the misclassification, including the billing fraud, and how you're approaching that.
Superintendent Evans.
Chair Robbins, Representative Greenman, thank you for the question. I think you answered a lot of it as you were going through exactly some of the things that we need to look at. Part of what we need to do a better job at is take a really holistic approach to fraud across the various schemes that can oftentimes, wage theft and misclassification are not necessarily, true fraud, but somebody's a victim of fraudulent activity that led them to the position to be in to begin with. When it comes to this, certainly those are policy considerations for all of you to make as to whether or not to intervene in a particular business model. Your reference that you noted, it certainly makes it easier for us as criminal investigators to prove a fraud in that mechanism if they're employees. There's more paperwork, there's other lacking of paperwork, a number of different things that we can look at, and as opposed to individual sole proprietors. But also there's a lot of sole proprietors that do really wonderful work in a broad spectrum of businesses. And so that's something that you can contemplate. To answer your question more specifically, we're doing a few things out of the gate, trying to do a better job to help agencies across the board learn from the investigations as they occur. One is we've started to build stronger relationships with MMB internal controls that works across the enterprise with the internal controls teams within the state agencies. We've had some initial conversations, and what we'd like to see is they already have ongoing meetings, but that we feedback as a feedback loop into those internal control meetings what we learn. That's part of it. It's outside of the scope of this particular meeting, but part of the governor's budget recommendations for this new unit is just three positions. One is a forensic accountant that would look at the financials to help aid our teams along the way. Two is funding to contract with two attorneys generals, and it really gets to the point of your question. One is so that they'd be available in Greater Minnesota to conduct prosecutions at the request of county attorneys, that these types of prosecutions can really strap a small attorney's office. However, two is that as we conclude cases that are either declined, we can't further a case, or it's concluded with a successful prosecution, is to work together with our team to provide information information as a feedback loop, not only to the state agency that referred the criminal fraud, so if there's process improvements that they could look at, systems, et cetera, but then also, again, for the enterprise as a whole so that we can really help learn from the state agencies. As you know, state government is very large, and so we need to figure out how, with this centralized unit, we can provide that feedback of information across the enterprise, and that's how we're starting to think about it now, in addition to working together with that, and then a number of the different trade associations. One thing that I think is important along the way is, you know, fraudsters, if they would put their, talents to use in the traditional non-criminal environment, they'd probably be fairly successful people. And so we need to continue having conversations. And I say that from a perspective of just last week, I was meeting with a number of stakeholders in one of the state agencies related to misclassification in a way in the contracting world that people have been working to thwart some of the things that you've already put in place to assist with wage theft, misclassification, not getting UI insurance, et cetera. And so, and it's adjustments along the way. So that feedback loop has to be continuous. This isn't a one-time thing. This is something that needs to be built into the fabric and ongoing.
Thank you. One more, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been waiting a while to get my questions in. So appreciate that. And to that feedback loop question, in the contracting world, in the construction contracting world, one of the things that we see and are dealing with is if there is organizations that are maybe cited by DLI or maybe criminally looked at, then what we see happen is maybe they dissolve and then some of those actors re-show up with different companies. I have heard from some of my colleagues who work in the HHS space that is one concern, I think, with the Kairos and the new way is that if there are folks and their businesses that are either because they are under investigation or because their business model, which was based on illegal behavior, is shut down, that then they show up in other spaces. In the construction space, we actually have been dealing with some of that. I'm wondering if there are recommendations you have, because to your point is if folks are perfecting a business model of fraud and one of their marks is government, it feels like dealing with those folks and putting them out of business is important. Are there recommendations you have, or maybe as you're thinking about it, that will help us in the space outside of construction to deal with folks sort of popping up with different legal entities and potentially coming back into the space, especially in the space where I've heard it might be happening?
Superintendent Evans.
I can start and then maybe be more specific for DHS related to this particular hearing. But Madam Chair and Representative, thank you for that. I think as you've probably noted in the construction industry that the fixes are sometimes many and nuanced, as you're referring. So sometimes it's very specific to the particular type of fraud that's being committed or lack of follow through and that's being done. In this area, I think one of the things in the conversation that we've started to have, and this isn't specific to DHS, is that with numerous different financial systems within state government, different grant programs, that there needs to be a better way to create a trusted identity process. In other words, that we know the same individuals across different government programs in that process. The type of activity that you say is definitely a concern. When you're able to form different, LLCs fairly easily and pop up again, we need to be able to understand then who is it that's responsible for those particular entities to see if somebody has been disqualified across the spectrum. DHS, and I'll certainly defer to them, has done a lot of work in this space already, but we are talking to them just as an advisor, and I know this is front of mind for them to try to figure out just that, and not just for DHS. We certainly don't want a fraudster that's been disqualified on DHS to be getting state funding in a different program. So I think this is an enterprise discussion that we need to have to make sure we know exactly who is receiving money in our state programs.
Thank you for that, Superintendent. I'd just like to follow up on that because I think this is a very important point, Representative Greenman. I think there is great concern that some of the groups that have been put out of business are going to reconstitute. And some of that, I know the Attorney General last spring shut down 17 nonprofits, and I have some of those resolutions here in front of me. But there's no evidence, that anyone has left the state or got out of business. So I think that's something I hope your new office will keep an eye on is do those 17 that were shut down by the Attorney General reconstitute themselves? And then in a related manner, the Attorney General did
do a settlement with Gargar Family Services. And the settlement, interestingly, was rather than that the money go back to the state, it was required to go to another 501c3. So all the assets of Gargar were supposed to be given to a different 501c3, and I've not seen what or if that has happened. But that would definitely be something to keep an eye on, that we're asking them to reconstitute. So I have concerns about that. And just to go back to the Kairos, I have one more question there. So my concern about the Kairos situation is that this was known for a long time. I mean, there are news reports going back to 2022 about how they were billing under statute. As you know, billing is supposed to be one-to-one for services and for transportation and for the peer counseling. And there were reports that they were doing group services, group transportation, and that apparently didn't rise to the level of stopping payment or taking action by DHS. So then in March of 2023, the Alliance for Recovery Center Organizations, ARCO, actually pulled the nonprofit Refocus Recovery's membership, which is necessary for them to keep billing for state Medicaid services. And they pulled it saying that they didn't meet the standards. So even though the state didn't take action, this accrediting group did. And in response, I find this stunning, Kairos's lawyer threatened to sue the state, and Commissioner Harpstead personally granted a certification so they could keep billing Medicaid. That's what happened. So DHS actively overrode this process, decided to keep billing Medicaid, and in 2024, until payments were cut off, they paid just in the first 6 months of 2024, $5.5 million to Kairos. And then the state apparently shut off payments on September 6th, and then the group shut down on September 19th. But that had been a pattern. People had known about it. It had been in the public record since 2022, yet we kept paying them. And this is my concern about the two autism centers. I don't know if there's currently being stop payment or not, but DHS in this instance overrode by a personal certification from the commissioner to keep paying this. Can you please address that and help us get confidence that those types of situations are not ongoing? Commissioner.
Chair Robbins, I will speak in generalities and say that because I can't speak for past situations that I was not intimately involved in.
But were you not in internal compliance at that time, Commissioner? What was your role before you became acting commissioner?
I was deputy commissioner and then chief compliance officer.
So you weren't involved in that decision?
No.
Okay, sorry, please continue.
Chair Robbins, what I know is that DHS works very hard under Commissioner Harpstead, also under me, to comply with rules, regulations, and to ensure that people get the treatment and care that they need. So I am aware of a different situation where we had a large residential provider that was not that was cutting too many corners, that wasn't following the rules, and that had some quality of care issues. And if we had taken action to stop payment, we would have had hundreds of people, vulnerable people, who didn't have a place to go. So instead, what DHS did, because they knew that large organization was looking to have a buyer to sell to another organization that was high quality, what DHS did in that instance was to allow the payments to continue and to step up visits to make sure that people were getting quality of care until that transaction could take place. So sometimes DHS does need to make a judgment call on the care that's being provided and the harm that would happen, and balance those. But it is very important to, first and foremost, not harm people, and second, make sure we have program integrity in our programs.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So back to the one-to-one billing, is that something that's now on your radar? And are you monitoring that with different peer recovery specialists and different transportation providers, et cetera? How are you addressing that? Because that seems to be a problem in the billing system in several programs.
Chair Robbins, yes, that is on our radar, and we are working to tighten legislation as well as our requirements, our rules, our guidance on how billing is to happen.
Okay, well, I appreciate that, but I just want to note that statute 254B.052 is very clear about the one-to-one billing, and I've seen that in multiple reports that you think something needs to be strengthened in statute. So whatever that is, please send it to us, because to me the statute is very clear, and that this continues to be a problem is of great concern. I think certainly we're happy to work with you on tightening statute, but I think the authority is clearly there already, so I hope that that is followed up on.
Yes, Chair Robbins, thank you. That was clarified. That was strengthened last session. Thank you.
Thank you. And so do you currently think it's sufficient, or do you still think there's more that's needed?
Well, so there's more that's needed across many aspects, as is in the governor's anti-fraud proposal, but the billing language is clear now.
All right. Thank you very much, members. It's been another very interesting hearing. I appreciate Commissioner Gandhi and your other testifiers and Superintendent Evans and Assistant Commissioner Steinmetz. Oh, there you are. Thank you all for coming. Have a great day.
Thank you, Chair.
We're adjourned. Robbins.